Why are they making noise?
Why are you making noise?
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 350 for the week of April 11th, 2021. I am special guest dog David T. Cole, and I'm here with Donkey PI Sarah D. Bunting.
I'm magical.
Cartwheel Queen Tara Ariano.
Did I do it?
And television watching bronze medalist R. Eric Thomas.
Think of me like Carrie Strug.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week, our 350th episode. Oh my God. Wow. Our guest this week is writer and former television Without Pity fan, as I learned in his book, Here For It, and I was here for it. It's R. Eric Thomas. Hello, Eric.
Hello. I'm so excited to be here. I am and was a hugest television Without Pity fan, so this is a dream come true.
Oh, thank you.
Misplaced, but thank you.
We're thrilled to have you here. We're going to get to our lead topic in just a second. But first, since Sarah was out dead last week, we did not get to hear her thoughts on Law & Order : Organized Crime. So we're going to have an emergency organized crime postscript for Sarah to give us her thoughts. Sarah, please take it away.
Thank you so much. Rumors of my death were slightly exaggerated. I think everybody covered pretty ably what I had to say, but I had planned to go back to the season finale that aired in May of 2015 just to check if I was right that the show was still painting itself into this impossible corner with Stabler's involvement in the SVU universe. And it was. Liv spent all of Amaro's last moments on the show throwing Stabler under the bus with one arm,
right,
while she had Noah in the other. I also wrote in this coverage, I'm sure we won't see much of the kid anymore. This is a procedural. Anyway, she never refers to Stabler in this big speech. But here's what I wrote back then, quote, "This makes no goddamn sense at all. I get that we couldn't see Stabler put in his papers on screen for whatever reason, and it's fine if Liv was bent about that at the time, but it's years ago now. Would they really not still know each other in this universe, even if it's off screen? After all the time she bailed his kids out of whatever stupid DUI fix and practically delivered Stabler at number 5 after that car crash?
Yep.
What's with the implication that their toxic attachment stunted her personal life? I'm pretty sure it was Liv's own unaddressed trauma with her shitty drunk mother and rapist father long after they had both died that prevented her from having a traditional home life and traditional self-esteem, not Elliot Stabler. And even if Elliot is the worst, most out of control detective at Manhattan SVU, asterisk, he was. Amaro was also terrible for 95% of his tenure on the show. Am I taking crazy pills? So, I mean, the show was so determined for so long to punish Chris Maloney for leaving, which he did because of contract issues, and that's why we didn't see any of that, And then they just never addressed it, and they had this chance, and what they used that opportunity at the end of the season 6 years ago to have Liv be like, you were my favorite partner ever. I learned more from you in 4 years than from unnamed in 12. And now they have to kind of try to walk this back. I will also note that at the end of the scene between Benson and Amaro, quote, Liv quavers, friends for life, right? So that's the thing that happened on SVU. That's what you're dealing with. Organized crime. I'm with Christina. Like, I'm kind of here for McDermott's wardrobe narrative, and I'm not sure how long that's going to sustain me, but I guess we'll find out. I've been hate watching SVU since God was in short pants. So it's going to be whatever it is. Thank you for coming to my live talk.
Eric, did you have anything you wanted to add?
I mean, I think between last week and right now, you've really covered it. I only watched the show because it is camp masterpiece that does not realize that it's camp, and which is very much in the Law and Order universe. But this feels almost specific, like they make camp choices and then they're like, but let's just take it back a little bit. The murder of Chaz, spoiler alert, the murder of Chaz Palminteri on top of Wonder Wheel. Well, first of all, the strangest acting I've ever seen from both actors. Chaz Palminteri looks like he's like, he's like having a, he's my sister, he's my daughter, he's my sister, he's my daughter, like moment where he's looking
McDermott
around. He
still
like,
thinks he's in a Ryan Murphy property also.
He really does.
I'm not angry at it. It's just a choice that was unexpected.
Yeah. The direction. Yeah. He's like, I'm going to do one assignment for the rest of my career. And apparently that assignment was do whatever Ryan Murphy says.
Yeah.
But like, why murder somebody in Wonder Wheel and then not throw them off of the Wonder Wheel? That feels very interesting to me.
Yeah.
Discovering a dead body. And then, you know, of course, I don't know. Stabler is, again, the worst cop in the history of cops. So I'm sort of like, none of this works for me, but I'm very invested in it.
Yeah.
What happened?
Absolutely is the train wreck, but with this amazing butt, and you can't look away.
What happened to killing people in alleys?
Right? Not
there
since Batman's
parents.
There
aren't that many alleys in New York.
It's true.
That's the problem.
There's lots of Wonder Wheels.
Right. Yeah.
And you got to pay an associate. Like, you have to hire somebody to run the gears for you for this murder. This is elaborate.
Nobody noticed that big, giant Ferris wheel going at midnight.
Right. Feed them to the two or three Irish wolfhounds. Like, they need more to do.
Amazing.
Agree.
All right. Speaking of large animals, let's get into our lead topic, which is doing the most with Phoebe Robinson. Comic, author, podcaster, one half of Two Dope Queens, Phoebe Robinson gets her own solo show on Comedy Central in which she spends time with a celebrity doing something they are passionate about. In the first two episodes, she learns about large animals with Whitney Cummings and tries gymnastics with retired gymnast and current talk show host Amber Ruffin. In the course of their time together, Robinson also poses three big questions to her guest because it's also an interview show, kind of. Let us go around the horn before we get into the nitty-gritty and briefly say, should our listeners watch this show, Eric?
I mean, yes, I think so, because it has Phoebe Robinson just seems like a great person to hang out with. And I think that's the major charm of the show. If you're not really interested in hanging out with Phoebe Robinson, you know, well, one, seek psychological help, but also, but this is probably not the show for you. But if you're, you know, it's like 20 minutes, you know, of like chill vibes and in a time when, you know, I don't know what you've been doing, but I haven't been physically chilling with a lot of people. It actually is kind of nice and refreshing. It feels light and maybe slight, but I actually found that to be exactly what I was in the mood for.
Okay. Sarah.
Yeah, for sure. Like, agreed right down the line with Eric. I think you don't have to religiously watch every episode or even each episode. You don't have to pay rigid attention to it, but it, well, I'll get into it when we get to the nitty gritty, but yes, thumbs up for sure.
This did not hook me, so I'm going to say no. But I will explain why. Dave?
I would also say no, although I agree she seems like a fun hang, but I suspect that it's more of a fun hang on the podcast stuff than it is on this TV show. And again, I'll get into my problems with this TV show in a moment.
Okay. Eric, let us start with a two-parter. What is your engagement with celebrity chat shows, and did you feel that this reinvention of the genre was effective?
So I am not usually that interested in celebrity chat shows. I didn't watch Comedians in Cars with Coffee and Croissants or whatever it was.
Good spinoff.
I am so compelled by an interview where it's clear that the people really, really like each other, you know. So like the Rosie O'Donnell show had a lot of those, her and Liza, her and, you know, whoever. Dave Letterman and his new show, My Next Guest Needs No Introduction, is sort of that way. I have not tried to figure out what this Barack Obama Bruce Springsteen show is, and I will die without knowing. I promise you that.
This Jersey native will also die without knowing and is going to get her citizenship card pulled. Oh, well.
But this, you know, so like in terms of the genre of like rich people who like each other. Like, mm-hmm. I'm like, I feel like it's a problematic genre, but I also like shamefully like it. And I thought that this was a nice translation of it. Watching them do random things that are kind of normal, but clearly not normal, because I don't have the capacity to like rent out a gymnastics gym in the middle of a pandemic.
So. Right.
Sure.
Sarah, you know I'm going to ask you to critique Whitney Cummings and her horsemanship. So please do that.
It looked fine to me.
Okay.
Here's what I liked about this. Phoebe Robinson, like, there was none of that. Usually in the first couple of three episodes of a show like this, there is some awkwardness while everyone is trying to figure out what it is and mm-hmm. who they're going to be in it. And I wasn't feeling that at all. It's possible that this was like the seventh or eighth one filmed and they just sort of were like, okay, now we know what it is. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I think she's just an easy hang and like a welcoming screen and audio presence. And that's what I really like about this. Like, there are moments in each one where all of a sudden the guest reveals something that's like quite personal, like not necessarily dark, but like you go into this intimate place that feels natural and supported, like not to be all woo-woo about it, but it has this, the show generally has this curious energy that I like, that like mostly the curiosity is about trying to find places to like get a joke in, but it's not like desperate about that. And when it takes these left turns into something that's more serious and not a punchline, mm-hmm. Phoebe is like ready for it and able to handle it. And I really like the warmth of the show. But at the same time, a lot of the times, like, there's not a whole lot going on, or like, you know, a donkey has a boner. Animals, am I right? Like, you don't have to be paying close attention to it. But then sometimes there is that like left turn that you're like, huh. So I was kind of like a little bit on my phone for most of the first episode. And then here we are at Whitney Cummings freezing her eggs. And it was like, oh, but that felt totally natural. And then we went back into more jokey stuff. So is it essential? No, but is it really like kind of arriving fully formed and good at what it does, which is just like watching people hang out? Yeah. But I mean, that's not going to be for everyone. It is a little contrived, I think.
Yeah, I agree that it is contrived. And I would say I found the day in the life of somebody who doesn't like animals whiplashing into the three big questions about dead fathers very whiplashy. And I don't think they handled the transition super well. I thought it was pretty abrupt. And I found generally that there should have been more yes-anding in this show than there was. I felt like a lot of the conversations stalled pretty quickly. It's very, especially the first episode, less than the second episode with Amber Ruffin.
Yeah.
But the first one with Whitney Cummings, there's a lot of, you could tell, editing around conversations that sort of stopped and had to be fibrillated back into existence. So I feel like there was a very odd choice for the first episode to have Whitney Cummings there because I didn't really get the energy that they were like really clicking. Especially when you compare it to the second episode, which I thought, you know, had more chemistry. It was just an odd choice. And a lot of the animal interactions just were very sort of boring. Like, it wasn't, like, when you compare it with things that are on TV that you expect when somebody who doesn't like animals interacts with animals, not to be, like, all cliche about it, but, like, Letterman and, you know, like, what's his nuts from the Columbus Zoo? You know, like
Jack Hanna comes
like
on.
You want to see an animal do something bad to a person, or at least that person being genuinely scared about it.
Yeah.
And this was like right in the middle of that. And it was like sort of unsatisfying as the first episode hook, that nothing really happens with the animals. Now, that might be sort of low-key vibe that you want to introduce, but for a first episode, it certainly didn't grab me.
Yeah. What did you think, Eric, of Whitney as the first guest?
That's interesting. Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. I think it feels to me that the show functions the best when, and you know, from having seen only two episodes, but functions best when the guest is also a capable host. It seems like it's a two-hander.
Right. Yeah.
Because if the structure is basically like when you get assigned to write a profile on somebody and like you have to go roller skating with them for right. color, you know?
Yeah. Right.
And you're both sort of like, we got a job to do here. And so I found myself very aware of the question in the first episode of whether Phoebe Robinson and Whitney Cummings are actually friends. I didn't have that question in the second episode.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I need to know one way or the other, but the fact that I kept thinking, like, do these people know each other? What is the relationship here? Mm-hmm. Which made the egg freezing question so, like, it stood out. I was like, why is Phoebe asking about freezing her eggs? What happened? So it's just very interesting. I also wonder, I'm sure that this show, their production timeline got knocked out of whack by the pandemic. It's very clear that the pilot is pre-pandemic and episode two is post. I wonder if we'll flip-flop back and forth. But I also do, I wonder if in another world, they maybe wouldn't have led with the Whitney Cummings episode if they had more in the can.
I feel like if she got one of her like actual close friends on, that would have been a much stronger first salvo.
Yeah.
Because I feel like the more comfortable she is, the better the show is going to be. But I feel that plays into her energy better.
Yeah.
And I feel like Whitney Cummings is...
Well, and horsey people are just weird
too. Well, yeah. Yes, you know. That is true. This is like not really super important, but the production of the show really bothered me. The cartoony stuff was totally unnecessary and kind of took me out of it.
A fan of that.
It's sort of like it's not annoying on the same level as Good Wife.
Yeah. Oh my God.
But they didn't need to be there. And also, like, there were some choices. Obviously, this is a very low budget show, but take 5 minutes on the second episode and get the color commentary gymnast audio in sync with his video. I know it was over Zoom, and it was like that when he recorded it, but guess what you can do in post? You just move that audio 2 seconds up, and you have video that matches his lips, and that's great for me, the viewer.
Yeah, there were a lot of things like that where it seemed like it was over-noted by Comedy Central, like the animated segment for sure. Yeah. It seemed like something that was added. Like that bit where they were doing it just would have been more charming if it was just them goofing around, like standing in the paddock versus like having the animated thing superimposed over it.
I think that's a pitch process problem. Like not necessarily the notes, but when you go in with a show like that, which is basically, I am a talented podcaster and I want to do this on TV, and that's your pitch, it doesn't have enough meat on the bones. So you start adding these things, which is what can I do on a podcast? What can I do on TV?
That I can't do on a podcast.
Right. Cartoons, weird, stupid little graphics when the goats, that kind of stuff. And it was all unnecessary extra bits that took you away from what was the strength, should be the strength, two people talking, and then, you know, stuff happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like the little visual indicators that they're like making sounds and laughing, like, why is that?
I was also confused about why we kept switching back and forth between cell phone video and regular video. Like, there's the one scene in the second episode where Phoebe is literally filming the same thing that the cameraman is filming. You can see the cameraman in the third shot. But we get Phoebe's cell phone video of Amber Ruffin doing a great gymnastics move, very gorgeous. And I don't know, like, the aesthetic of the show... You know, it seems to begin with Phoebe doing front-facing video where she's getting ready and then going out to do her thing. I don't really know. I don't know that I need, and again, maybe, you know, like, I think that's a really good note about the show being over-noted. I don't need a whole lot of setup. It's sort of like, these people are talking. They're doing a weird thing. They probably don't regularly do this. Enjoy.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. If you have a personality in your title, that's your main draw.
Right.
And you don't need all this foo-fara around that.
Yeah.
It's time to go around the dial talking about stuff we've been watching on TV lately. First up, Tara.
Not so much a highbrow, lowbrow this week, just two middle brows. First, Kung Fu. This is a very loose remake of the 70s action show of the same name. Nikki Shen, who's played by Olivia Liang, drops out of Harvard and moves into a Shaolin monastery in China to study Kung Fu. Her mentor is killed and a sword is stolen from the monastery, which also burns down. So Nikki goes home to San Francisco, obviously Vancouver, to figure out what to do next. Her family's kind of pissed because she's been gone for 3 years and they haven't heard from her. Also, her mother in particular expected her to graduate from Harvard and get married, so she's especially mad. But any shame that Nikki might bring on the family is kind of eclipsed when it's revealed that her dad, played by the great Sima, borrowed money from a loan shark and now they're really in trouble. So Nikki decides to stay and try and take down this criminal organization that lent the money and is generally preying on the neighborhood while also researching what was up with the sword and the mysterious woman who stole it with the help of a local art history student who's super hot. So it's very CW-y in terms of a show with, like, a lot of kung fu in it. This is not on the level of Warrior, like, with the fight scenes, but they're actually a lot better than I was expecting, I have to say, given the venue. And the performances are really good. Nikki has a nice sibling chemistry with the actors that are playing her brother and sister. And the creator is a Chinese-American woman, Christina M. Kim, which was not the case with the original show. I like Cobra Kai a lot, but it definitely has a problem showcasing a Japanese martial art in a show with not really very many Japanese actors other than old footage and photos of Pat Morita. So I appreciate that this project is in the hands of a creator who is from the community that she's representing. I don't know if I'll keep watching it because of the CW-ness of it. It's more for a teen audience. It's no Katie Keene, RIP, but I was interested enough that I'll probably watch a couple of more. It's on the CW Wednesday nights. Dave, you also watched it. What did you think of Kung Fu?
I think it was a perfectly fine CW show that I will never watch again.
Okay. I mean, there it is.
Yeah. I also watched Home Economics. This is about three siblings. One is rich. He's a finance guy. He's played by Jimmy Tatro from the first season of American Vandal. He played.
Oh, my God. My heart.
I know. I love him. One is poor. She's a social worker. One is in the middle. He's a novelist whose last few books tanked. He's played by Topher Grace. And the whole show is about the poorer siblings worrying about money and wanting their rich brother to give them some. But guys, just because he has money doesn't mean he doesn't also have problems. He's getting divorced. And yeah, if old internet heads remember Modern Humorist, a site that was not very funny, it's from the guys who created it, John Abood and Michael Colton, who are TV writers now. And they start with this money premise, but then they don't really think any of it through. Like, the novelist is married and has a kid plus infant twins. And his wife is like, I could go back to work. And he's like, he's like, no. And we also never find out what she did. Like, she says, I could go back to work at the firm. Like, what firm? But the constant talk about money is just stressful. Like, this is why money never almost comes up on any other show. It's not funny or fun. Like, this is not something people want to talk about or think about. The show is bad. Don't watch it Wednesday nights on ABC. But you can read my review on Primetimer. We'll link it in the show.
Eric, what do you got?
I have been watching the CBS sitcom Sybil, starring Sybil Shepherd as Sybil Sheridan, a figure very loosely based on her life, as is the case with many sitcoms. Sybil ran for 4 seasons on CBS. It was a Chuck Lorre production. I'm not usually a fan of the Chuck Lorre cinematic universe, but I have to say, Sybil is a lot of fun. It actually holds up. The premise is Sybil is an actress in her 40s who never really got her big break. She is twice divorced. She has 2 ex-husbands who continue to be in her life. 2 daughters, one with each husband or ex-husband, and most delightfully, a hard-drinking best friend played by Christine Baranski, who won a couple of Emmys for the show.
Yeah, she did.
It is available on some combination of streaming sites that I accidentally stumbled upon through my Amazon stick. It just sort of showed it to me and I can never get it back. So I keep having to pay for it. Yeah, I have a portal open. I walk through the closet, literally go back through the closet to this series that convinced me back in the late 90s that, yeah, I think I might be gay and I love this.
Was Fichtner on that show, or am I thinking of Grace Under Fire?
He was on Grace Under Fire.
Right, okay.
According to Just Watch, it is on Roku, and Pluto TV, among others.
Pluto.
Oh, my God.
That's
yeah.
It's not even a planet, motherfuckers. Stop.
It's a really, it's if you're looking for something that just, that feels, that's from the 90s, but feels unproblematic in retrospect, this is a good choice. It's a beautiful precursor to Will and Grace, obviously, the Karen Walker character. And I think everybody involved has said the Karen Walker character owes a huge debt of gratitude to Marianne's character. And I think it's also a precursor to the show Better Things in a very, very different world. But looking in an honest and funny way at the trials and tribulations of an actress over 40 is a fascinating topic that is worth many more television shows. And unfortunately, we haven't gotten that many more television shows, but we do have Sybil somewhere in the universe. And if you can find it, I recommend it. And that is all I have to say about Sybil. Although I probably will say more on any one of my channels. So you can feel free to follow me on Twitter for more Sybil related nonsense. That's our Eric, OurEric.
Sarah DeBonte.
Okay. I would say a lowbrow and a highbrow, but it's like really more a lowbrow and an unfurrowed brow. So let's start with that one, the Great Pottery Throwdown, which has been recommended to me many times in the sort of fallow periods between a bake-off season. I was like, I don't know, pottery? Like, how are they going to fill the time? Well, they fill it. I mean, it's just very... like the rhythms of it are close enough to Bake Off. The accents, like it is absolutely like a tour of British dental mistakes. potting, I remember from being a kid, like we had a wheel and a little kiln at my school, and it was like my output was lumpen at best, but it was an extremely soothing process, even for someone who is extremely impatient and likes to do crafts that have like immediate positive results. And it's just as soothing to watch, but also like it's fun for the 5-year-old in you because there are big brown blobs of things. And also when they're trying to make handles, there's this pulling process that it ends up looking like a dick, and then the jerk off motion happens a lot. So if you are extremely immature like myself, there's that. And then you get some history woven in there. It's lovely, actually. And it's on Netflix. There's 4 seasons, and enjoy. Oh, excuse me. It's on HBO Max.
I was going to say.
And now to the lowbrow. I
can't believe you watched this. I can't believe you chose to watch this with your precious time.
I know. Well, here's the thing. United States of Al. I was watching a lot of NCAA basketball, and they were advertising this, like, not heavily, but they were advertising it enough that, like, every time Dan and I saw an ad for it, we were like, wait, they're still going to try that? Like, we thought after the first ad and after Twitter was like, guys, no, that maybe they would, like, at least use a different ad. No, it went ahead on April Fool's Day, which, like, right up to the end, I was like, maybe it's a bit. It's not a bit. I assume that everyone is familiar with the premise, which is basically that this, you know, guy gets veteran, after years of trying, gets his translator from when he was in the service from Afghanistan to, I guess they live in, like, near Columbus, Ohio. Sure, I'm never watching it again. You can at me if you want. And the central premise of the show is that he's like, what if Balki, but in 2021 when everyone has the internet and from Afghanistan? So look, if this is also a Chuck Lorre cinematic universe product, and that kind of multicam business is not my thing usually, but I'm not going to count off for that. I watched it to see how something like this managed to get made in 2021 and try to understand what was happening. And I still basically don't, because I think this is your basic problem, is that Balki and his his like childlike balkiness at sort of like teaching Americans how to love and break down their whatever, like that's not going to play in an internet having world. Mm-hmm. The character in the pilot has a line of dialogue where he's like, you know, we have Wi-Fi. And it's like, okay, if you have Wi-Fi, how do you not know what air quotes are in this promo? Like, figure out exactly how toothless and unsexed and empty this character needs to be and at least be consistent with it. Actually, right. Don't, because it's gross. I mean, I believe the creators are on the record, possibly like retro engineered this reason, but they're like, well, we want sort of like middle American red state people to like, we wanted a palatable version of this character. Ugh. Like,
ugh. Yeah,
that's okay. I mean, you can't argue with that quote logic. Here's me doing air quotes. I know what they are. I have Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
Here's another problem that this is what I can't get past. The show is actually trying maybe to come up to the margins of some real, fairly dark shit, which is okay to joke about. And it's like the only thing the armed forces are good at is like joking about their black shit mm-hmm. amongst themselves. About PTSD, about the ripples of trauma through military families, mm-hmm. about broad-ranging issues facing veterans. But it can't quite bear to look at these things head-on in the way that, for instance, Enlisted was really good at doing,
yeah.
And you can't get Enlisted out of your mind because one of the leads in United States of Hell was on Enlisted.
Yeah.
En conclusion, just go find Enlisted. This, I mean, I think I sort of understand what is being attempted, but like even subtracting the Chuck Lorre-ness of it all, it's like, guys, like just do the thing. Just write the character. And I don't know, maybe cast it appropriately.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, it's a shame. That actor is not bad. He's good. He's trying. He's worked plenty before this. I don't know why he took this role. I hope this gets canceled fast. It's shitty. for my plug, I will link to our past guest, Roxana's United States of L review at rogerebert.com. She gets into a lot of this stuff and more.
Yeah.
I will also note that Tara Ariano appeared on the Quaid in Full season 4 finale about Something to Talk About. And I'd like to wish a happy birthday to longtime listener and TWAP visitor, Radish Cake. Happy birthday.
Hey, happy birthday, Radish Cake.
All right. I'm just going to say briefly, I'm not going to get into it, but the Pennyworth season 2 finale dropped last night. And boy, I love this show. And it's such a shame that it's on Epix, where there are 17 people who subscribe to Epix across the globe.
Yeah.
And
what if stars, but even harder to find?
Yeah. Half our listeners are like, what is Epix?
Now you're just making shit up.
Yeah. In between stars and reels lives Epix.
Oh, reels.
Really good show, really smart show, doing a lot of playful things with sort of the Batman backstory that feels just incredibly new and fresh, but somehow very familiar because this is weird alternate reality of British 60s. Really loving it. Second season wasn't quite as strong as the first, but it was still really good. And I kind of worry that it's not going to get a season 3 because it's Epix and it looks like a really expensive show. I'm hoping best case scenario is Epix drops it, and then that lets HBO Max / DC Universe-esque stuff, they can pick it up and put it on HBO Max, where it can get a really big audience, because you know, that has become one of the essential streaming services, I think. Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Because I feel like I look this up and then it just falls out of my brain every time I do. What network or sphere does Epix belong to?
MGM owns it. So it's not really, it's sort of on the side.
Okay. Because they actually have had a couple of good, really, like, really good documentary series that I wrote up and was like, don't sleep on this channel that I assure you, you
is real.
Yeah. It does exist.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, they've put out some good stuff in the past few years. It's just that they just don't have the membership to really see a show through to mass market popularity. It's just not happening for anything they do, even though they have good stuff. Like Get Shorty season one was great. You know, like there's a stuff there that is really worth watching, but nobody knows where it is. Chances are you have no idea if you have it or not. It has, like, apparently the network started as Epix. It's not even pronounced Epix. So I don't even know if I'm saying it right. Am I going to be communicating it to you correctly? It's just a mess. It needs to be rebranded.
And if it expands, what's the plural? Epices, Epixes.
Just sold to HBO Max or whatever. Like, just take over the catalog and stick it in one of these streams. Please don't start an Epix streaming service. Please don't do
that. Oh my gosh.
Anyways, on the next Extra Extra Hot Great, it is New Bat Time, New Bat Channel. We are going to take a Batman villain from one of the Batman TV shows, and we're going to put them in another show and explain how that jazzes it up.
To be clear, that's the title of it, not what's happening with it. It will drop the same time it usually does in the same place.
That is available to all supporters at any level. Thank you very much, all you supporters. Patreon.com/extra hot great. And then next week, right here on EHG Prime, it is season two of Couples Therapy, something that Tara seems very excited about.
Very excited.
And that is with a good friend, Catherine Van Arendonk from Vulture.
It's so good. I just finished watching it yesterday and wrote my review. It's excellent.
It is time for the canon. This week, a user submission from Kate. I just want to let you know up top, the recording wasn't super great, so I had to do quite a bit of processing to get it up. So it's a little crunchy, but still very listenable. So here we go. Take it away, Kate.
Hi, Extra Hot Great. Today I'm presenting Ugly Betty, Season 1, Episode 18, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, for submission into the EHD canon. So after devouring Superstore, on your recommendation, by the way, Hulu's algorithm decided I might also enjoy America Ferrera's first vehicle, Ugly Betty. I was impressed by how many aspects of the series still hold up, and I'm a little surprised it's never been pitched for the canon. Even on a 2021 watch, it's obvious how groundbreaking it was for its time. The show follows Betty Suarez, a Latina aspiring writer from Queens with braces, glasses, and an unconventional fashion sense, who lands a job as assistant to the editor of Mode, a Vogue-inspired high fashion magazine. Adapted from a Colombian telenovela, Ugly Betty broke a lot of barriers. With diverse voices making creative decisions, the show hit home for a broad audience that wasn't used to seeing itself represented on network TV. It placed a Hispanic family and protagonist squarely at its center, and over the course of its four seasons, dove headfirst into racism, misogyny, LGBTQ issues, and immigration, all couched in delightful telenovela-style drama, which was also new for American TV audiences. It featured the kind of character chemistry that only comes from solid writing and a cast that truly loves each other offset. This episode in particular, I think, represents so much of what made Ugly Betty great. Point one, self-awareness. An inner beauty is what counts premise is difficult to execute well. Ugly Betty pulled it off by staying devoted to Betty's unwavering good nature and the self-confidence instilled in her by her supportive family. The show also knew just when to wink at the audience to signal that it was in on the joke. It was this self-awareness that provided the scaffolding for the zany, campy, colorful, and sometimes cheesy bits. A recipe that kept the show both heartwarming and relatable.
Daniel, you've done a great job running this magazine for the last 6 months. I know you can win this race. It's like the tortoise and the hare.
Okay, I'm gonna figure it out. You can cross my pep talk off your list today.
There will be more.
Point two, Wilhelmina Slater, full stop. Vanessa Williams brought star power to the series in her Emmy-nominated role of Wilhelmina Slater, Mode's creative director. Despite working her way through the ranks of Mode for 25 years, Wilhelmina is passed over for the position of editor-in-chief when it's given instead to Daniel Mead, the unqualified rich kid playboy son of the big boss. This experience is all too familiar for women, and especially women of color, having to work harder than your white male counterparts and getting passed over for a deserved job because of nepotism.
So, both of you are editors-in-chief. Alexis is an editor-in-chief. Daniel is an editor-in-chief. Seems like practically everyone in the room is an editor-in-chief, except for me.
But what was even more significant than what made Wilhelmina familiar was what made her new, a Black woman in charge. She was ruthless, savage, and unquestionably the villain, but she was also uninhibited, unapologetic, and secure in what she deserved. She was no stranger to sacrifice and answered to no one but herself. For mainstream TV, this was a breath of fresh air and quietly revolutionary.
It's almost scary how easy this is.
You are evil.
I'm so going as you for Halloween.
Point three, a multidimensional trans character. Alexis Mead, Daniel's transgender sister and long-lost heir to the Mead Empire, was one of the first characters of her kind on network TV. Now, I want to be clear. There are plenty of problems with Alexis's portrayal throughout the series, including messy pronoun use, confusion between gender and sexuality, and the fact that she's portrayed by a cisgender female actress, as much as I love Rebecca Romijn in this role. But that said, I think this episode gets it right. Alexis herself, like Wilhelmina, is powerful and unapologetic, but the show doesn't shy away from showing the emotional toll that transitioning has taken on her. Even though she's known since she was 5 that she was in the wrong body, she admits that her great comeback as a woman was not fully what she envisioned, and her relationship with her father in particular continues to pain her.
This is the life you wanted so badly.
Actually, in the life I wanted, you were behind bars.
And in the life I wanted, you were still a man. You remember making me this? You were 6. After you disappeared, I'd look at it to remind myself of the son that I'd lost. Now it reminds me of the son I wish I'd never had. You and I were finished.
We were finished a long time ago.
Alexis's family, similarly, is a showcase for the various responses to a newly transitioned loved one. She is dead to her father, as you just heard, but accepted completely by her mother, while Daniel is just angry and hurt because he's grieving the loss of his brother.
Hey, how are you feeling?
I've been talking with the new lawyers, and they seem to think if we go with them...
That's not why I called you here.
What's going on?
Your father tried to fire Alexis today.
Tried. I did.
But you can't. She's your child, and she's your sister. Now, I'm probably going away for a very long time, and I want you all to be a family.
I don't think Alex wants to be part of any family, Mom.
Alexis. And she'll never be part of a family if you keep pushing her away.
Which brings me to my final point, portrayal of the many different shades of the gay experience. Of the series' regular characters, 2 identified as gay, Betty's teenage nephew, Justin, and Wilhelmina's assistant, Mark. Justin's series-long discovery of his sexual orientation is one of the show's crown jewels. Literally established in episode 1, Justin's character arc culminates in the penultimate episode when he dances with a boy at his mother's wedding as his family members exchange quiet, loving glances at each other across the dance floor. Justin's journey inspired a generation of kids to come out and a generation of parents to accept them when they did. And while Justin's coming out is a close second for the canon, I would argue that Mark's confrontation of his mother in this episode both paved the way for Justin's journey and gave voice to another underrepresented group, LGBTQ folks who face the impossible choice of being themselves or keeping their families.
The Golden Girls Marathon is on!
And I don't even know what that is.
That?
He's just so swishy. The mother doesn't say anything. It just makes me sick.
Okay, shut your mouth, Mom.
What did you say to me?
You don't get to talk about these people like that. They did a really nice thing for me tonight. And that little boy. Swishy, swishy. You want to talk about swishy? Open your eyes, Mom, and look at your own swishy son.
You know what? No. I gotta get to the hotel.
No, no, no. You don't get to go. Because I may never be this brave again, Mom. I love you, but...
Do not say it.
I am what you think I am.
You're confused.
No, no. For once, I'm not. If you want to get to know me, it has to be the real me.
The real you, huh? Well, if this is the life you've chosen, I have no interest in knowing the real you.
As Michael Urie, who played Mark, often pointed out in interviews, the happy TV easy path would have been for Mark's mother to just learn to accept her swishy son. But instead, the show allows her to reject him and literally never come back, an experience all too true for so many people. These kinds of writing choices are the hallmark of this show and what endeared it to so many devoted fans who finally felt seen.
You know what, Mark? I learned something about family tonight. They're not always the ones who love you the most. Sometimes it's the family that you make for yourself.
Okay. Getting a little too Lifetime original movie for me.
See what I mean about self-awareness? Ugly Betty was a groundbreaking series and an important demonstration of the kind of TV that can happen when diversity is prioritized at every level of the creative process. This episode highlights much of what made the show exceptional, and I hope you consider inducting it into the Extra Hot Great canon.
Thank you, Kate. Eric, you picked this from our list of submissions. Why don't you start us off?
Yeah, I was very excited to see Ugly Betty on the canon submissions list when it was originally airing. I was in my early 20s and I was obsessed with it. For many of the reasons that Kate listed, I think I would often describe the experience of like laughing for the first 45 minutes and then like sobbing hysterically for the last 10, which is my ideal Thursday evening. America Ferrera is sort of unparalleled in this role. The writing is really great. This episode was written by Marco Panett, who is very good at taking things that happen in his real life and putting them on television to it. He's currently represented on network television by the show Be Positive, which is a show about a person who needs a kidney transplant, I believe, and it's inspired by Marco Panett's own journey to getting a kidney transplant. So, you know, coming soon to a television near you, whatever's happening in Marco's life. I was originally a little bit unsure about this particular episode being included in being the Ugly Betty canon choice. One, because of I do think the show does a good job for 2006 in working with Alexis Mead, right. Its trans character, but it is not good enough. And the strength of the show really is in the writing around America Ferrera's Betty Suarez character, Vanessa Williams's character Wilhelmina Slater. But Vanessa Williams actually did not win any Emmy for this, which is a crime that should be persecuted at The Hague. That said, I love the highlighting of Michael Urie's character in this episode. Michael Urie's a phenomenal actor, he was up to this point in the season, sort of just kind of Wilhelmina's henchman. And so getting to see him come to the fore in this episode, getting to see them laying the groundwork for Justin's eventual coming out, and also seeing Patti LuPone playing one of the many like strange, rigid homophobes that she's played on television completely out of character for her in her, all her Patti LuPone-ness. Just, you know, just an all around great showcase for a really talented cast.
Sarah.
Yeah, that's about where I am. Like, I'm just not sure. Like, it's such a shame because I think Rebecca Romijn is really bringing it in this role, but she should not be in this role. So where does that leave you? I would also like to note, in addition to the actors already mentioned, first of all,
Literally everyone is in this episode. Greenfield, Christopher Gorham, the great Judith Light, my acting North Star. I love her so much. She's amazing in this. Becky Newton as the desk girl is amazing. Also, her delivery of that exchange about how the pregnancy scare was not fake. Like, it's just so over the, it's really over the top, but it's also like peak Devil Wears Prada realness for me. I thought she was awesome. There's some little throwaway lines in like slapsticky scenes that I loved. And Eric Mabius, I just watched him in a biopic about the NBA referee scandal, AMA, just kidding, no one cares. And he's always like better than he gets credit for at being, like, he's always cast as this like talentless cheekbone arrangement. And he's really good at acting like someone who's bad at stuff, including sometimes acting. I had not spent really any time with this show, and this definitely made me want to keep watching it and keep investigating its universe. And that scene with Michael Urie is heartbreaking, and especially that it's Patti LuPone. Like, there's so many layers to that, and you can actually kind of hear her gears grinding, that she's like, well, here again, after playing a Law and Order defense attorney who was the same kind of shitty, I get to be this kind of shitty as Patti LuPone. So, I mean, this was extremely compelling. I think this is a really great show. I want to watch more of it. But Romaine as a trans woman, like, how, like, there's just a couple of things in which ways in which it might be a little too mid-aughtsy for me to get past, but I'd like to hear what everybody else thinks too.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the hang up, right? And, you know, this did air in 2007. That's when I think the Alexis character didn't come back until then. And, you know, it was only a few months later that we had Candace Kane playing a trans woman on Dirty Sexy Money.
Mm. Right.
So, you know, you can't really say people didn't know, because they did. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
But it also was a long time ago. Like, I take Kate's point. Like, I do think they do a good job of showing, like, the range of what would probably be people's, you know, uninformed reactions in a family to this bomb going off. And I definitely agree about Mark's plotline being the showstopper. And, you know, this episode, the show was just unparalleled in casting, like, diva queens. Like, in this episode alone, Judith Light, Vanessa Williams, Patti LuPone, Becky Newton, and Anna Ortiz, I think, is up and coming, like, divas too. Like, both of them, so
for
great.
For sure.
But yeah, the Alexis, just everything around her is sort of, that's like, it's a problem. So, you know, it's a shame, because they almost got there and then not quite. Dave.
Yeah.
A long time ago, we had a I Love Lucy in the canon, or rather for the canon. And the episode was like the comedy you can see, but there was a lot of like bad gender politics and gender power imbalances that you could tell through the story. And it was a lot of sort of like low energy hostility that doesn't really translate very well today when you watch it. And we were like, okay, we can appreciate it for the comedy chops it has and the jokes it is telling, but the overall, you know, 2019 and whatever it was that we watched it, view of it is icky enough that we didn't feel comfortable putting it into the canon.
I mean, trying to teach that in that class, it was like the disclaimers took longer than screening the episode, not least for all the cigarettes. Oh my God. Ricky, take it easy.
And there's ways to appreciate a piece of culture that is out of sync with the values today. Right. And you have to separate sort of like the good from the bad. But that separation doesn't mean you have to hold it in high regard still. You know what I mean? Like, it is fine to say this episode has a lot of good qualities, but this one thing that is definitely behind the times means, like, I can't recommend it. Like, that's fine. Yeah. That's fine to say. And it's fine to say that one thing also doesn't mean the rest of the show is bad. Right. Like, all these things can can exist at the same time. Now, as far as the canon goes, I would say that is reason enough for me not to put it in the canon. Out of tune enough to say, like, I wouldn't want that to represent what the canon is about, or to say, like, this is a, you know, this is a cross-the-board quality episode type of thing, right? There's enough there that it makes it feel like we got to pull back from it. That said, just a few notes on things that happened in the episode that delighted me. My absolute favorite part of the episode was at the start, where they literally do an actual literal smash cut. I thought that was, it actually made me laugh.
Yeah. And then after the moment, I was like, oh,
I see what they did there. That was a smash cut. That was actually pretty, pretty clever.
And then the nephew just being like, it gets funnier each time. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not wrong.
I looked at Tara to see if she would look at me, because that was definitely like when Tara slipped on the stairs in the winter and landed right on her tailbone, and me and her sister were trying not to laugh super hard. Every time I think about that now, it's funny.
This also happened outside my house.
Yeah.
Still waiting to get sued, frankly. Don't even live there anymore.
Yeah. What is up with Daniel's hair? He is like,
oh God, yeah.
He is, Muppet feels hair. Like he's about to go play something in Gotham.
Yes. It looks like the hair on my husband's werewolf mask.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just that Mr. Suarez is so upset about being locked in his house for 2 weeks or whatever.
It's like, I miss the smell of the grass. The grass smells like fried onions was one of my favorite lines. It's true.
So my takeaway is there's a lot to like about this episode, but let's just not forget about its historical place in the universe right now, which is it does some things wrong and it's fine to call it out on it. Despite the rest of the show being quality.
Just a small note that Mr. Suarez's parole officer, the episode prior, was played by future Oscar winner Octavia Spencer. Which was the first time I encountered her back then. And I was like, this woman is wacky. She's never going to win an Oscar. And I was wrong.
All right. Let's put this to the official vote. Eric, what do you say?
I think no. I think there are other episodes of this series that could work.
Sarah?
It was an excellent presentation, and thank you so much for bringing me into the Bettyverse. But for all the reasons stated, it is a regretful no for me as well.
It's a no for me, too, even though I love Ugly Betty. And I would also say, I feel like this is kind of an under-the-radar show that people miss. So if you love Younger, for example, this is a show that you should check out. It's on Hulu.
And I will say no as well. A little too much of a mixed bag here. So... Ugly Betty, Season 1, Episode 18, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You're hereby not inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
Well, it's time for Winner and Loser of the Week, and I have this week's winner, and this week's winner is Ancient Aliens. Dun, dun, ba, ba. That means, Tara, we're talking about Ancient Aliens. It's time for the Ancient Aliens test. It's been a while. Can Tara pass it? Let's find out. Nope. Tara, who were they?
Aliens.
Why did they come?
Gold?
What did they leave behind?
Us.
Where did they go?
They're still here.
Will they return?
I just said they're still here.
Perfect. You have passed the Ancient Aliens test. Now, why is it the winner this week? Well, one of the showrunners on Cobra Kai has signed a deal to make a feature film adaptation of Ancient Aliens, which on paper sounds really fucked up and unnecessary and like, what? But here's what I'm thinking and why I'm actually excited for this. What if this is basically National Treasure meets Chariot of the Gods?
Yeah.
I am ready for that. Because we watched National Treasure movies over the pandemic, and they are dumb.
Yep.
And they are like totally mass market, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean crap.
Yeah.
But boy, are they tasty.
They're really watchable. Mm. They're on Disney Plus, by the way, if you want to check them out.
That needs to be a series. Like, somebody should make that a series. Mm-hmm. But I feel like if they take that energy and turn that into a sort of globe-trotting, ancient aliens-tinged treasure hunt or knowledge hunt, that actually could work.
Yeah. And they have to have George in it, not as a star, but as, like, their Stan Lee. So that you have to be like, there's that Stan Lee of George, what's-his-face.
Yeah, completely agree.
Close, what's his name?
Yeah. So, yeah, again, Tukulos, yeah.
Tukulos.
Against all odds, I am actually kind of in on this project, so.
Oh, I was in the minute you mentioned it, so, yeah. Yeah.
Who has our loser and what is it?
I have our loser. Ryan Reynolds was like, don't renew our show. And ABC was like, okay, because don't, that game show that we talked about in the summer when it premiered with Dan Casino, Casino Noise, has been canceled after one season at ABC. Womp womp.
Yeah, from the hack. You did this to yourselves, naming files.
Honestly.
Speaking about doing things to yourself, you know what time it is? Everybody, this is only the second game time of the season. Last week was non-regulation because Sarah died. So the season scores currently are Tara with 1 point. Everybody else still waiting to get on the board. Today we are playing Connective Tissue from Amelia with the help of the Handsome Devils at EHG Assist. Amelia gets an extra credit topic of her choosing for her troubles. In today's game, I will read you a blended description of two TV characters from separate shows as they merge into one character. The resulting chimera has a name that also borrows from each character. One of the character's last names is the other character's first name. You need to give me that name. So here's an example.
Okay.
A subpar paper company regional manager moves to Colorado with his fiancée, only to be cruelly fed pieces of his parents at a chili cook-off. Two characters involved there. Their names run together. What would that character be?
Oh, Michael Scott Tenorman.
Michael Scott, Scott Tenorman, Michael Scott Tenorman. That's how it is. So two characters, their names run together, before and after kind of style.
Got it.
Make sense?
Yes.
Yes.
Steel meal situation, please, Tara.
Thank you, Dave. Sarah D. Bunting has 3 steel meals. I have 5 steel meals. Eric, as our valued guest, you have 2 steel meals. So how that works is if someone else gets the answer wrong, before Dave gives the correct answer, you can jump in and say, steel meal, and you can steal their points. But you have to be fast before he gives the correct answer.
Yep.
I take it there are no hints or layers or whatever.
There are.
Just one.
Oh.
If you cannot get, I will let you know the shows involved. So 2 points without the show, 1 point if I give you the shows.
Okay, got it.
All right.
Gotcha.
We're a little tight on time, so we're going to go a little fast on this one. But
all right.
I think we're good. We got 40
no
minutes.
No equalizing?
No, we're going to skip the equalizing this time. All right, let's throw it to Pinky to see who is going first.
We will start with Tara.
All right. Tara, Sarah, Eric, are we ready to play Connective Tissue?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Yes.
Tara.
Yes.
A Scotsman in love with a time-traveling lass hangs out at a Boston bar before moving to Seattle.
Jamie Fraser Crane. It's Frager.
You ought to know. You're Frager. Yep, that's how you do it. We got Jamie Fraser from Outlander, and we got Fraser Crane from Fraser and Cheers and all that jazz.
Yeah.
2 points. Sarah.
Yeah.
To escape the taking it personally toll of working with special victims, this character opts for an easier life as the head of a household for a widowed governor.
Oh, hi, Picky. Oh, my God. But what is his last name?
Yeah.
All right. Olivia Benson.
What is his last name?
Benson.
I told Sarah, I actually thinking about this, that there are 2 questions in this quiz that are the most Bunting questions ever. This is
Benson,
one of them.
Benson, I actually just looked up the governor the other day because I called him John Noble, and obviously it's not that. It's James Noble. Benson, oh my God, it's something French. Too.
Benson Honeydew.
Benson Honeydew. Yeah.
Anyone?
All right, that is, does anybody know?
No.
Olivia Benson Dubois.
Dubois!
All right, here's your first one, Eric. A former teacher turned drug kingpin finds his world turned upside down when his body is resurrected in a lab by a shady government operative working for S.W.O.R.D.
Oh, my God.
A former teacher turned drug kingpin finds his world turned upside down when his body is resurrected by a government operative working for S.W.O.R.D.
My brain is broken.
Do you know any parts of that? It might help you if you talk it out and name some character names.
Yeah, okay. So I think we're talking about the lead character from Breaking Bad, which apparently I've completely forgotten what his
character's
name is.
That's going to be a problem.
If you don't know yeah, so I'm already sort of lost. and I don't know. The S.W.O.R.D.
If you're not sure about any, I can give you the hint that might jog something about the second one that maybe you can work backwards.
Yeah, I'll take a hint.
Okay. The shows we're talking about are Breaking Bad and WandaVision.
Okay, right. So, oh, man. Okay. Bryan Cranston played Hindenburg. Oh, my God. I know every...
Did you just call him Hindenburg?
Yeah. Yeah. Anna Gunn. I'm literally just, like, paging through all the characters.
That's going to be a tough one if you don't remember.
Walter White! Walter White Vision?
Hey!
Hindenburg.
All right, I gave you Walter, so I'm going to give him 1.5 points for that.
That's fine. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's just one because you gave him the shows.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Okay, oh, that's true.
You can have the 1 point. That's good. Okay, back to Tar.
Yes.
Tired of doing all the gross work in a Pennsylvania pub, this character relocates to the West Coast in a much more affluent zip code and is a bitch about it. Charlie Kelly Taylor is correct. That's Always Sunny and Beverly Hills 90210. Sarah. Oof.
Yeah.
A wisecracking rabbit takes over as a police commander in Baltimore's war on drugs.
Oh, fuck. I mean, would watch. All right. Bugs Bunny Colvin.
Yep, that's right. Oh.
Nice.
Whew. Eric. The tech guru at Wayne Enterprises finds himself obsessed with alien conspiracy theories and begins a search for the truth, which is out there.
Okay. Oh, my God. Okay. Lucius Fox Mulder.
Yeah.
That is correct. 2 points.
Wow.
Gorgeous.
Tara.
Yes.
Starfleet's boldest captain downshifts to small-town life as the local eccentric, cycling through an endless stream of ridiculous jobs.
Oh, God. What was his last name? It's James T. Kirk. I'll never know his last name. James T. Kirk Dickface. I have no idea. Anyone?
That's James T. Kirk Gleason.
Okay, if you say so.
Kirk of all trades from Gilmore Girls.
Yes.
Back to Sarah. Oh. Picky is... A Baltimore stick-up man with a code, now he whiles away his time with his family on the Cartwright Ranch.
Oh, fucking bonanza. All right.
Last year, there were three.
What's the matter? You don't like bonanza? If this is not right, then I don't know what it could possibly be. So let's try Omar Little Joe.
Hey.
Correct. Oh. Our little Joe from The Wire and Bonanza. To Eric. Good-natured but dim-witted bartender starts blowing shit up in rural Kentucky with the goal of getting a DQ franchise.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I think we're talking about Woody Harrelson's character. I don't remember his name.
Do you want the hint?
Yeah, I'll take the hint, yeah.
All right, you're correct. We're talking about Cheers and Justified.
Oh, yeah, that's a blind spot for me. I'm going to forfeit that one.
Steel meal.
Take it away, Sarah.
Woody Boyd Crowder.
Woody Boyd Crowder is correct. Boyd Crowder.
Nice.
Is that one or two?
That is one.
Okay.
1 point.
Cute.
Tara.
Yes.
A punk computer programmer disrupts the Silicon Prairie and discovers a parallel world of doppelgangers, intrigue, and espionage in Berlin.
It's Cameron. It's Halt and Catch Fire and Counterpart, but I don't. I don't know. I don't know. I give up. Cameron something.
Tough one. Cameron Howard. Howard Silk. Cameron Howard Silk. All right. To Sarah D. Bunting. When the powers that be in the village demand information, This fast-talking best friend is happy to oblige.
Fuck. I don't remember her last name. Dog is super unhappy about it.
How could you not remember? It's my favorite show.
Bear.
Ah.
Bear. Arr.
You're a disgrace to the family.
It's true. He should know.
We want information. Rah, 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 rah. Information. Rah, rah, rah.
Just, okay, give me a...
Sorry. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I don't know. So... it's number six and then six something, but
yeah, I don't remember last name either.
Dubois?
No, it's not Dubois. It does sound look kind of French. Lemur? Lemur?
Not
L-E-M-E-U-R-E.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Fuck.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's The Prisoner and Blossom.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
Of course.
All right, Here's our next question for Eric. It'll take us into our first score break.
Okay.
Chechen mobster who spends his time drinking beer in an alley with his Texan friends.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Which is a scene I could actually kind of see happening without too much troubles.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we're talking about Barry and King of the Hill. Who are the guys in the alley? Boomhauer. Yeah. I don't know. I'm gonna...
Anybody?
NoHo Hank Hill?
NoHo.
Of course. NoHo Hank Hill.
All right, that'll take us into our first score break. Tara, what are the scores?
Very close game. Eric has 3 points. I have 4 points. Sarah D. Bunting is in the lead with 5.
All right, everybody has 4 questions left, but we're changing it up a bit.
Okay.
Still the same premise, 2 words that connect together, but we're no longer sharing a last name. It just phonetically runs into each other now.
Okay.
Okay.
Here we go. Tara.
Yeah.
Duct tape, a can of aerosol, a Swiss Army knife, and a Jeep is all this young California detective needs to solve crimes in town.
MacGyveronica Mars.
Please say it properly.
MacGyveronica Mars.
That is correct for 2 points. So MacGyveronica Mars.
Yes.
There's the connective tissue there. Sarah.
Yes.
When her husband's political scandal somehow brings about the apocalypse, a Chicago lawyer must become her family's breadwinner by moving to Atlanta to fight zombies.
Oh, God. What is that guy's name?
What is his last name?
Yeah. I mean, okay. Well, we're
talking
about...
I'm Homer Simpson. Doe, doe, doe. That's his last name, if that helps you at all.
It doesn't.
Okay. Helps me.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just burned Tara. Tara can no longer participate in the steel meal for this one.
I'm not going to steal it. That would be unfair.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to just hope that we never get a last name, but it's Alicia Florrick. Nope.
Alicia Florrick Grimes. Rick Grimes. That's the good wife in Walking Dead. All right, Eric. This prejudiced grump from Queens spits bile at minorities, commies, meatheads, and any puppets that weren't around back in the good old days. It's not easy being green.
Okay. Archie Bunker. Not easy being green. Oh, Archie Bunker Mitt the Frog.
Archie nice. Bunker Mitt the Frog is correct. 2 points. Tara.
Yes.
In this fantasy world of swords, magic, and frequent nudity, a young woman with pet dragons grows up to seduce Geralt of Rivia.
It's Daenerys, but I don't know what the other character's name is.
Oh, boy. I was hoping to get it right so I didn't have to even try to pronounce this.
No. Daenerys. Sorry, buddy.
Tara Yennefer of Vanderburg. Let's just pretend I said it right.
Yeah.
That's Game of Thrones and the chick from The Witcher.
The Witcher.
Closer than I'd have gotten.
The Witcher season 2 when?
Question 17.
Spread Eagle.
It is for Sarah D. Bunting, and it will conclude our most Sarah D. Bunting questions in the history of universe.
The pressure.
After saving a fictional town in upstate New York from being frozen by a supervillain, an assistant DA harbors concern that their dismissal may be because they are a lesbian.
Okay. It may be because they are a lesbian. this is in the canon and Ugly Betty isn't. Just a reminder that we are terrible. Okay, so that's Serena Sutherland. Can I hear the clue again? I'm sorry.
After saving a fictional town in upstate New York from being frozen by a supervillain, an assistant DA harbors concern that their dismissal may be because they are a lesbian.
Frozen by a supervillain. I just...
You can ask for the hint if you're not sure. You still cap that one point.
Oh, yeah, true. Can I have the hint, please?
All right. General Hospital and Law and Order. Yes, that's right. Supervillain freezing a town apparently happened on General Hospital.
That seems like more of a poor Charles thing, but I believe you. I mean, geez, Serena Sutherland.
Well, the solution always follows the clue order.
Oh, okay. So it is in the order. I mean, I just don't know. Alan Quartzer Maynderlin. I don't know. I'm sorry.
The answer we're looking for is Luke Spencerina Sutherland.
Oh, yes. Fuck. I think I actually saw that episode too. Joe Reed, I am sorry.
Eric. Whoops. Nope. You
can't. That's a precursor. We're disconnected.
Sorry about that.
Tear.
The star of The Rural Juror turns out to be the worst dancer on the Upper West Side.
Okay. Oh, God. Star of The Rural Juror is... oh, my Lord. I don't remember any character names. Jane Krakowski. Worst names on the Upper West Side. I don't know.
You want the hint?
No.
You don't even want the hint?
All right, I'll take the hint.
30 Rock.
Yeah.
And Seinfeld.
Oh, Elaine Benes. So the first is... What is her... If I could remember Jane Krakowski's character name... Tracy Jordan and... I don't know.
Anybody?
Jenna Maroney Lane Bennis.
Jenna Maroney
right?
Lane
Bennis. Jenna Maroney. Yes, I'm sure. Handing in my gay card. This is an embarrassing.
All right, this is question. 19. For Tara.
Yeah.
After a stint being heard producing voiceovers in London, he decides to join the U.S. Marine Corps for some reason.
Hint.
Toast of London. And blank, blank, USMC. Blank, blank being a title character's name.
Stephen Toast.
Let me read that clue again, just so you have it. After a stint being heard producing voiceovers in London, he decides to go join the U.S. Marine Corps for some reason.
Clem Fandangomer Pyle.
Wow.
Wow.
Would watch.
Correct. Sarah.
Yes, I can hear you, Clem Fandangomer Pyle.
The coolest character at Arnold's Drive-In suddenly finds his world threatened by Cylons and uses his skills as a fighter pilot and politician to combat them. Whoops. Jeez, my finger.
Dave.
I actually know this one. I understand everyone was really disappointed in the Luke Spencer thing, but I'm pretty sure this is Arthur Fonzarelli Adama.
Yes.
Yay!
2 points. Wow. Happy days in Battlestar. Correct.
Damn.
All right, this will take us into our second score break for Eric. A bisexual icon faces a choice. Continue living in a small town or running a store that sells fancy local goods, or... return to a life in New York as a tough-as-nails detective in a precinct full of lovable weirdos. Take a stab at 2 points or ask for a hint, I'll give you the shows.
Yeah, I'll take the hint.
Schitt's Creek and Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Oh, so David Rose... David Rosa... What is Rosa's last name? David Rosa. Oh,
just imagine when people just call her by her last name, as cops do.
Yes.
Is it David Rosa Torres?
Oh
no,
no, Diaz.
Diaz.
All right, that'll take us into our second score break with one question left for each of you.
It's still literally anyone's game. Eric has 5 points. Sarah and I are tied with 7 points.
All right. Let's see what happens. Tara, your last question is...
Okay.
After a fight with her best friend's evil doppelganger, a CIA operative goes missing for 2 years while she becomes the youngest member of a family of five.
Oh, God. Youngest member of a family of five. I need the hint.
All right. The shows we're talking about are Alias and Five, Party of.
Oh. Sydney Brist. What was that fucking kid's name? Sydney Bristowin Salinger.
That's good for 1 point. 1 point. Sarah Day Bundy.
But at what price?
If you can get 2 points here, you clinch it. The father of the last son of Krypton takes a job with the NYC police, using his rage issues to protect special victims.
Oh my God.
This is a pretty Sarah question also. Yep.
I would watch this as well.
Can I hear the first part of the clue once more just to confirm?
The father of the last son of Krypton takes a job with the NYC police using his rage issues to protect...
Okay, just confirming which L, and I believe it's Jor Elliot Stabler.
Jor Elliot Stabler is correct. That's a great combo.
Well done.
I'm exhausted.
Yeah. All right, Eric, closing us out. An eccentric 19th century teenage poet goes undercover to infiltrate Miami drug rings while sporting white blazers and pastel t-shirts.
Oh my God, this
please make the show.
This is made for me. Emily Dickinson, Sonny Crockett.
Emily Dickinson, Crockett, Dickinson,
I must
and Miami
have
Vice.
The show exist immediately.
Is correct. And that ends regulation. Tara, final scores.
Well, this was a hard-fought battle. Congratulations to all of the combatants.
Yes,
Eric finished
indeed.
With 7 points. I had 8. Sarah is our victor with 9.
Oh, yeah. 7, 8, 9.
Didn't even have to freeze a village. Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. I have the tiebreaker here, which will just read first person to shout out the answer wins the steel meal for future use. Eric, okay. You'll be playing for a future value guess. Here we go. Shout out the answer as soon as you know it. A Midwestern city employee learned her idealism from her pa, the sheriff of Mayberry.
Leslie Nopey
Cunningham.
Leslie Nopey Taylor.
There you go.
Oh,
Taylor Cunningham is Happy Days character Ron Howard played.
Right.
That was Parks and Rec in the Andy Griffith Show there. Tara wins that steel meal, but today belongs to Sarah.
Sarah.
All right, everybody, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We did the most we could with doing the most with Phoebe Robinson before going around the dial with stops at Kung Fu, Home Economics, Sybil, the United States of Al, the Great Pottery Throwdown, and Pennyworth. I'm here to tell you that Ugly Betty's Don't Ask, Don't Tell did not make it into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time from Amelia and EHG Assist. Next up, Bat Villains Jump Ship on Extra Extra Hot Great, and on the next EHG Prime, Couple Therapy, which Tara still seems quite excited about. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David Teagle, and on behalf of Tara Ariana.
Sorry to Kirk Dickface.
Sarah D. Bunting.
So, this is where the tragic happens.
And our Eric Thomas.
Looking for that national treasure.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Hey, this is pretty cool. You should try it. It's great. It'll be fun. Did that sound convincing?
Not really selling it.